those systems are not just going to crumble on their own. They're based on power and privilege, and nobody wants to give that up when you have it. So what we're doing right now, having these discussions, owning our own narratives and saying, no, I don't want you to tell me what my family is like. I don't want you to define health for me. This is what I do. That's an act of resistance.
Welcome to She's Interesting, a podcast about business, money, and well-being. I'm your host, Rochelle Hariri. I'm an award-winning marketer, consultant, and I'm a startup advisor. I'm so excited today because we have a very special guest. This episode is very much focused on the well-being of She's Interesting. So in this episode, we are welcoming Dr. Pauline Yegnazar-Peck.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So honored to have you on the show. Dr. Pauline, she is a trauma-informed psychologist in Santa Barbara, California. She drove down to LA for me to do this interview with her. Thank you so much. She specializes in helping the daughters of immigrants and intercultural couples break cycles of intergenerational trauma so they can reconnect to the essential goodness of their cultures and live full, free lives in deep connection with themselves and others. Her work fills in the gaps left by immigrant upbringings and Western psychology. Don't I feel that? She is the founder of the group practice Noor Therapy and Wellness, through which she and her team offer individual, couples, family, and group therapy. Pauline also runs a free book club called Cultured, on top of her signature one-on-one culture and connection transformation program and Roots and Fruits programs, which are available to women all over the world. Pauline, we are going to go really deep today. Thank you for being here.
Oh, I'm so glad. And yeah, that's what I love to do anyway, is like get into all the good stuff. So let's do it.
I want to start from the beginning. Can you share with us the journey that led you to specialize in trauma therapy, focusing specifically on daughters of immigrants and intercultural couples?
Absolutely. I don't think I set out to do it. And I get a lot of messages now from young therapists that are like, how do I do the work you do? I'm like, honestly, I don't know, because I did not set out to do that. I didn't even start out to be a therapist, but I was dealing with my own pain. And when I was dealing with my own pain, I had, you know, somebody recommend therapy for me. My mom had died. My life felt like it was in shambles. I was experiencing depression, but I didn't even know what I was going through. And a friend said, you should try therapy. And it felt like, that's so weird. Why would I go talk to a stranger? I don't know if I can afford that. That's not for me. But I was desperate. So I went, and I had this, I always say it was like this twofold thing of, I simultaneously realized how powerful and transformative it could be. And I also felt like, okay, those reservations that I had about it not being right for me are still there. There are some pieces that I don't feel like my therapist is understanding, or, you know, it doesn't quite feel like a complete cultural fit. And so I set out, right, that was in, I want to say 2009, to get into school, figure out, like, I shifted my entire career track.
What were you studying before?
Sociology.
Oh, okay.
So I was on track to being a sociology professor. I just finished my master's. I'd actually been getting calls from the PhD programs in sociology that I'd already gotten into, asking like, hello, are you going to put in your, you know, yes, and tell us that you're coming? And I completely did a pivot. I had a professor that I was working with that was like, you would be a great therapist. I think this is your calling. Literally picked up the phone, old school, called somebody he knew at USC's social work school. A few weeks later, I'm in the MFT program, which was housed in the education department. I started school a month later. So I am not the person to ask young therapists about how you do this career track, because I really was just following what didn't feel right for me and learning as I went. And then in school, it was amazing, but I was always the annoying one who's asking for whom, and I don't know if this would fit, and what about these cultures? And I was continuously getting the, we'll learn the theory first and then we'll figure that out. If we have time, we'll get to. And so it always felt like culture was kind of an afterthought. Went on and got the PhD. And even in that, I was that same annoying person asking all of those questions until finally I realized, okay, this is something that, because I'm trying to make sense of, I'm sure others are. Let's just dive deep into doing this. And I don't think you can do this kind of work without looking at trauma. You know, there is a lot of trauma to unearth and uncover and understand. And so that ended up being where it kind of took me, but really it was my own personal pain and trying to understand myself, make sense of myself as a cultural being, and to heal from what had happened to me. That was the impetus. And that's kind of how I got to being who I am.
How old were you when your mom passed away?
Early 20s. So 24.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 24. So a year later, 25, I'm in an NFT
made this
program.
Life change.
Made this big life change. And really, my mom's death was like such a clarifying thing. A death like that at so young, I think just it like shatters the life that you knew and completely destroys it, but also clarifies what's important. It's like at the same time as your, you know, development is, you know, completely disrupted, you also have access to how life is short and
yeah, your mortality.
Absolutely. And you're just like, what is important? Like, I don't want to be in that year. I broke up with the person I thought I was going to marry 4+ years, but it wasn't a right fit. Like, he was a great guy, but he wasn't great for me. I, you know, didn't do the PhD track, completely shifted, moved back to this coast. I was living in New York. Like, everything in my life was different, but I was also much more in tune with where it was that it was my path. And it's been a windy path getting there. Again, I did not set out to say, this is the woman I want to help and I've got all these tools. It was just following my intuition and figuring out at each step what it felt like by being embodied and mindful and intentional.
And I think that's really an amazing lesson for anybody who's listening to the podcast right now, which is if you are at any age looking to make a difference and your gut is telling you this is what you should be doing, you should go for it, because if your intuition is guiding you somewhere, it's basically what's meant to be. And stop resisting and pushing against it, because that's when you actually end up really unhappy and miserable.
Yeah. Or following an old script.
Yeah.
So I think that I just say, you don't have to make the perfect decision. You just have to move in the right direction and then be in touch with yourself. And so that's kind of how I got to sitting here in front of you.
That's amazing.
Listening to it, and maybe I'll be going in a variety of other directions. Like, that's the thing, is like you have to let go and surrender a little bit to it, which can be really, really scary for a recovering perfectionist and somebody that, you know, has
someone
had
who
that
wants
track.
Control.
Absolutely. And we all want that. I always say there's a tension between, you know, the desire for control and also the desire for spontaneity and newness and possibility. Those are tensions of human existence.
What's your take on how cultural identity and mental health intersect, particularly for immigrants or children of immigrants?
Yeah, there's no way to disentangle those two. I don't even see another way. Culture is both the identities that you hold, right? The various kind of demographics and the identities and the various saliences of each of those identities. That sometimes your ethnic identity matters a lot. Sometimes your religious identity matters a lot. Sometimes you being a woman is the kind of thing that you're working through. And so just because you have these identities doesn't mean that they're all impacting or that you're in the same relationship with each of these various parts. There's that, but it's also your value system, your worldview, and how lived experiences, depending on those kind of identities and how you have relationships with them, all of that goes into this kind of soupy mix of who you are. And there's no way to disentangle that from when it is that you might feel that you have a mental health struggle, where those distinct lack of fit happens between the person and the environment, times where you feel maybe alienated, relational conflicts, like everything from your relationship to yourself, your relationship with other people, your relationship to the environment. There's no way to talk about mental health as an objective mental health. The for whom? Like, the mental health of whom? Who is the person? And their entire cultural landscape and canvas is integral to understanding them.
So why do you think it is that not enough, in my opinion, not enough therapists look at this holistically? Like, I've been to therapy. I've talked to a bunch of my friends who've gone to therapy, and it's sometimes not considered. And so even more recently, as I'm talking to some of my girlfriends, women of color, they're saying, I'm seeking out a therapist who's also from a similar background or a person of color, so that when I'm complaining about things at work or I'm talking about, you know, like a relationship issue or issues with my parents, they understand me better versus being like, hold up, you're in a toxic family situation. You need to have boundaries. You need to cut these people off, because that doesn't take into context the cultural background. Like, a lot of immigrant families or a lot of cultures were very family first. And so it's not the best advice to just be like, cut off everybody. You know, that's not how it works if you come from like a Middle Eastern family.
The simple answer is that we don't get trained in that, right? The training that happens in the West, if you are in mental health of any kind, social work, counselors, MFTs, marriage and family therapists, psychologists, we are trained from Eurocentric models. We are told this is psychology. Whose psychology? We learn white, Western, colonial frameworks of psychology. You don't hear about people of color who have been doing mental health treatment, but in a variety of holistic ways. People who treated the body, people who are going to spiritual figures to be able to talk about mental health. So it's like the West and Eurocentrism have made it so that that's the psychology that we are trained in and that we learn. And so a lot of people lack the training that then incorporates these things. And then if you don't have an identity and a lived experience where you're like, that doesn't fit for me, which I had, that doesn't fit for me. That doesn't fit for my family. And I'm a systems person. I was a sociologist, so I'm a macro level person. I'm like, I'm having this individual experience, but are there others like me that are having similar experiences? What are the patterns? Who does this happen for? That's kind of like the way my mind works, that I started to see, okay, I am an example of how that doesn't fit. And okay, what am I doing in my life? So I journal and I'd look through my journals. And very early on, I had thousands of daughters of immigrants that I was working with because I had many training experiences. And I'd say even before I got licensed, probably close to 10,000 hours of therapy. So I was one of those that said yes to everything. Okay, overachiever over here. So after seeing all of those women and hearing from their life experiences plus my own, I was able to begin creating, okay, look, let's do it this way and then test that out. Okay, how is this working in my life? So imagine you don't get the training in school and then maybe you don't have the lived experience for yourself. And so then it's so easy for you to completely ignore, other than the one multicultural class you took, how important culture can be. So the lived experience is important, but also I've known people that go to therapists of color and still have that experience where they don't feel like culture is being really taken into, because it's not just what you look like, it's what you're thinking like, it's your worldview, it's your way of kind of moving through those problems, it's your value system. And so that's what we have to confront. It's not just the lived experience and the cultural match with your therapist will help them understand the words that you're using, understand what that person means and not misinterpret some of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get really good culturally informed therapy. Culturally informed therapy has to do with, did I increase the training that I got? Am I learning from, if not my own lived experience, then reading, educating myself, going to different cultural things, really making sure I have real life relationships with people outside of my culture? That's how it's going to happen. If not, the way that the standard training for therapy is not really culturally informed in the way that most people need.
How do we overcome these systems that have been in place for hundreds of years as people that want to be heard and seen and to be cared for in a way that works for us?
We're doing it right now.
Yeah.
I was just talking to somebody else about this in an interview about, I feel like this is our moment. So many children of immigrants have now, through the instability, but then the sacrifices and the hard work of previous generations, we are now moving into not just more stability for ourselves, but actually into those systems. We are now CEOs. We are now,
the
change makers.
Yes.
We are now the top in the media. It's like, if we're not being invited to those tables, we're making our own tables.
Yes.
And so I really see the shift beginning to happen. Those systems are not just going to crumble on their own. They're based on power and privilege, and nobody wants to give that up when you have it. So what we're doing right now, having these discussions, owning our own narratives and saying, no, I don't want you to tell me what my family is like. I don't want you to define health for me. This is what I do. That's an act of resistance. You saying this therapy is not working for me, I'm going to go either seek out somebody who I do feel is more culturally informed and a better fit, or something outside of therapy. Like, I'm a therapist that is continuously talking about the healing that happens outside of therapy. Like, God forbid that my, career goes away. It's like, let that go away. I'm sure we can figure out other ways of healing that maybe don't involve all of the problematic forms that happen within the structure of therapy, because most structures were rooted in these white supremacist, racist, misogynistic, patriarchal, colonial systems. And they do need to be dismantled. And we're doing it when We own our own stories and we begin to be the change makers within these systems and to divert these systems and create new systems that can be more inclusive. Like these conversations, they are resistance one little step at a time.
They say a lot, like you, if you know where you came from and your family history and your ancestry, it helps you to understand the traumas in your family and how that's formed and generationally passed down to you. But to people like myself who don't have a strong family history, how do you go about coaching them or supporting them in therapy? Is that even something that you talk about?
There are a multitude of ways to know. You can know and hear. You've got facts, you've got figures, you've got, you know, family members that are alive that can tell you stories. You have documents. That's one way of knowing. That's a very concrete, cognitive way of knowing. There are other ways of knowing that are body, that are spirit. There are things that you know in your bones. You don't have to have all the facts and figures. One of the biggest pieces I had to grieve when my mom died at 24, a few years ago, my grandmother died. And those women had held so many facts about my life. And then becoming a parent and not having my mom or my grandma around, I felt like my history is lost. But there are times, whether it's through my own work, through my own healing, whether it's journaling, whether it's just being in deep spiritual reflection, there are things beyond my cognitive understanding that I'm connected to. And if I can trust in that, that's going to be its own way of being able to move forward. You don't have to have all the facts and figures to be able to know where you come from. Now, the beauty is, can you read about it? Can you research about it and see where it hits you? You might research something and then your dreams are vivid and you're working through something. You can be doing EMDR. You can be in church or at mosque or having a spiritual experience and something comes to you. Can you go with it? So far, so much of what we want to know is like top down and you have to know everything. And if you don't know it, then it's all, that's a really perfectionistic way of dealing with your healing. There can be people that are not alive. There can be histories that maybe you've lost, but they are within you. And there is always a way to connect to the past because your own body is the map.
Yeah, you carry it with you.
You carry it with you. And you don't have to know all of those things to actually be in touch with something that feels bigger than you, to know that you've come from people. I don't really know beyond my great-grandparents. I could do ancestry. I could, you know, research. Again, we're living in an age where you can get information. But I know my people struggled, and I know my people were resilient, and I exist today because of it. And I know there were very strong women in my family line. Like, I wouldn't be me without that. I don't have to know their exact names, but I know in my bones.
It's with you.
It's with me.
Yeah.
And so it is like a process of surrender and trust and really allowing those other pieces to come forth, not just trying to intellectualize the process and feel like if you don't have if I don't know how I was, it used to really like a really specific example. I was like, I don't even know. Was I breastfed? For how long? And that for me was like this big thing. It's like, here I am trying to feed new babies and I don't know how that happened. And I was like, I know that my mom went with maybe what I needed. It's what I can, I come from a long line of women who have mothered in a very natural way. That for me was like, can I go with that? And I had dreams. I had so many vivid dreams when I was pregnant.
Yeah.
Of just times where I would envision, I don't know, being enveloped in the love of like all these women and all these ancestors.
That's so nice.
Like seeing me off to sleep because I had all the sleep issues that come with pregnancy and insomnia. It was like there's a knowing that happens internally because it's with you. It's not going to be something you have to think your way through. And that's so uncomfortable for people. It's like we want to know.
I'm raising my hand.
So then we can make that perfect link rather than allowing ourselves to be these holistic and intergenerational beings, which is much harder, but honestly is much truer to the nature of this kind of work.
Even for me, as I mentioned, I don't know a lot about my family history. Like I know a little bit about my grandparents, but they passed when I was really little. And my mom is older. She's closer to being 80. My father passed away when I was really young. So I don't have a lot of these stories. And so I always felt like I was missing out on something because I don't have these really clear stories of your great-grandfather fought in this and this is what happened. And so I always felt like I was missing out on something, but I really like the way that you've position this because it's, I do feel connections with different things that I see.
Yeah. And then you can go with those little nuggets. It's like there maybe is one story, or you can ask questions. I think sometimes people think that what they got is just what they got, rather than can you initiate some of these conversations with those that are living, with family, friends, with other people that might know. So I remember asking so many people. I finally found out who was even present at my birth, because my dad is a terrible historian of all things that have to do with kids. I think that part of the generational and kind of traditional gender divide.
Oh, for sure. Some of them weren't even in the room.
Yeah, it was like, I went to get tea. I don't know. It was like, was it morning? Was it night? We drink tea all the time.
Yeah,
like, when was it? He's like, I don't really know. And so like, I didn't know all of those things, but that piece of, I know that there was artistry. And then look at the Iranian culture in general. Creativity is so a part of it. And so then you go and try out a pottery class and see what it does to you. I had a client once who, I'll change some details, but basically went and did a certain craft and was in tears the entire time. Something intergenerational is happening there. She doesn't have to know that her great-great-grandfather, you know, made this kind of thing. She's engaging in something that is healing for her just by being open, asking those questions, and being open to the process of finding out what those answers are in collaboration with her body. So we can kind of pull on those little strings. You don't need the, like, here's a journal of the last, you know, 150 years of our, you know, family. Most people are not going to get that. But don't be afraid to ask questions of those that are around. Don't be afraid to just read about your people in general. Things will come up for you, and you can then lean on those and experiment with new ways of connecting to your culture and see what comes up.
I just feel like the term trauma is just being thrown around so loosely these days, and it's easy to blur the lines between what actual trauma is versus having a situation that made you upset. It's like a human experience to be upset. So how can we tell the difference between the two, and how can we stop misusing trauma? Because I think there's so much meaning in the word, but everyone's just throwing it around like it's a new fashion trend.
Yeah, well, I think this is the problem with therapy jargon becoming how we talk, because then it's completely out of context.
Yeah.
Trauma is already hard to define because it is not an event. It's an experience. So I can't tell you if three people go through a car accident and it's horrific, I can't tell you who's going to be traumatized from that, because I don't know intergenerationally what each person was holding. I don't know what the current life stresses in their life were and how it impacted them in the current moment as they went through this really difficult thing. I don't know what supports they had afterwards. I don't know what the real lived realities of their lives were and who was there to support them through whatever they went through. I don't know so many facts that would then be able to tell me how this person is able to absorb it. The way I define trauma is when your internal resources are not enough to deal with the situation at hand and your nervous system is overwhelmed. And so you go, you know, that's an experience. It's not an event. That can happen because of chronic stressful situations at work and school, or it can happen because of like an acute thing like a car accident. So it is difficult to define because it's so idiosyncratic and it's going to depend on each different person. Trauma is not, I was just activated or upset.
Yeah.
Right? That's not.
You get triggered. Everyone gets triggered.
Yeah. And triggered itself is pulling yourself back to a particular moment where you were overwhelmed. So even I was triggered, I like to say I was activated. I got upset. I had a reaction. That's much more than I was triggered. When somebody is triggered, they're literally being pulled back and experiencing it as a previous moment in time. And it can be linked to traumas and woundings. The way that trauma operates is that when something overwhelms us, it becomes almost solidified in our bodies like a PDF. It's no longer an editable Word document. Because our body and brain want us to remember that in its totality and to be able to continuously make sure that we don't get hurt in the exact same way. And so even if there's some associative similarity with the situation at hand and the thing you experience, it goes right back to the PDF rather than being able to be malleable and editable. And so the work of trauma work is really being able to go back to that incident and incorporate new resources. It's like, now you're not a child. Now you're not alone. Now you've got health insurance. Now you have a therapist that's sitting and talking with you. Now you have wonderful friends and community members who will feed you when you go through something difficult like a medical emergency. Yeah. Right?
And you have tools now.
You have tools now. Yeah. And so we can go back. The work of trauma is going back and resourcing so that a previous experience can then be metabolized, because the body is so, I wish that people understood how amazing the body is. Our body is a natural adaptive information processing system. You get an infection and you get a cut, you go to sleep, your body's working on healing itself. You don't have to think about the healing of your finger. Do you know you've got ways for your body to discharge the stress and trauma from your body on a daily basis? But when our nervous system gets overwhelmed,
yeah,
then we need to manually bring in those resources so that we can almost like help that go through the information processing system and not get stuck in that PDF. And we do it by increasing the resources in the present. So I don't think you can do culturally informed work without being trauma informed, because you have to understand the way that trauma is passed down from generation to generation. And one other piece I'll say is that because you don't know what's being passed down, someone can say, I'm traumatized by this. And you say, that's an, you know, overreaction to that. You, again, don't know intergenerationally what they're holding on to. So if they've had all of these intergenerational pieces that have overloaded their nervous system, it's like they're not starting life with a nervous system that's resourced. They're already starting with an under-resourced, stressed nervous system. And then they're parented in a way by the person that's part of this intergenerational nervous system
exactly,
who exacerbates some of that. Yeah. And then they've had life experiences that have added to that. So it's really not up to us to say, oh, that thing and this, that's an overreaction. It's like, it might be an overreaction from your nervous system, but if not for them. But I do think that because we use psychological jargon and therapy talk, it does a disservice to everybody. I think we've got to have better words for saying, I got activated, I got upset, that really, you know, bothered me. It's like, those are fine. That made me angry.
Yeah.
Just to say that made me angry.
I don't know why people don't actually name their feelings.
Right.
Like, if you're upset, say I'm upset. If that made you angry, say that you're angry, versus like weaponizing therapy as a way to like be like, oh, well, that triggered me, or oh, I'm traumatized now. What happens if you don't deal with your trauma, if you're constantly trying to ignore it, or, you know, maybe it was something happened that was so traumatic that you don't even remember and it's in your subconscious? What happens to you as you age? Does it start to surface?
What trauma does is twofold. It distorts our view of ourselves and it distorts our view of the world. So let's say you did experience childhood trauma. The distorted view of yourself, a negative view of yourself, would be, I'm bad. I deserve less than. I don't deserve healthy, nourishing relationships. And your view of the world is that people can't be trusted and they're all going to hurt you. So while, yes, not everybody is trustworthy, and while, yes, you have things to work on, both of those are negative forms. So you're always going to have a negative, distorted belief about you and about the world. And that's a result of the trauma that you experience. That's almost your brain's way of making sense of this.
Is that kind of like when you have, let's say, friends in your group that are just always like pessimistic, always expecting something negative to happen, and always feeling like, yeah, of course this bad thing would happen to me because bad things always happen to me.
Yeah. And it doesn't even have to, again, be your own life experience. It could be passed down. And so if you don't deal with it, it is going to, I'll say it in this way, it's going to impact the way you relate with the world. And it's not going to be relating with the world in a way that is full of possibility. It's going to hinder you. It's going to make you small in some way. Trauma and being traumatized leads us to try and prioritize survival above everything. But if you just only prioritize survival, you'll never experience the fullness of living, the fullness of risking for a relationship, for love, for me in my 20s making this huge change and saying, I got to do it because my gut's telling me, it's like something in you is going to miss out on fully experiencing life.
Yeah, because you always want safety.
You always
and security.
Want and need safety, because your body gets accustomed to this. And the more you actually meet your, you know, trauma brain with actions that are in line with that, the more your world gets smaller and these beliefs get solidified. So you don't have to deal with it. And I'll talk in a second about when it surfaces, but you don't have to deal with it. Just know what you don't deal with, future generations will. Some people say, I'm not going to have kids. And that's okay. And I've seen many people actually intentionally choose not to have children to stop anything being transmitted.
Yeah. Okay?
And that's somebody's choice. That's the beauty of living in this time as a woman. You can choose not to have children. You can choose to have children alone. You can choose all sorts of things, but it will pass on. And so many of us are dealing with the trauma that was not processed before. The thing about trauma is when you have, like you talked about your journey with anxiety, when you have stability, it's like your body and brain that is geared for survival can finally take a deep breath. It's like, finally,
like literally you feel the muscles relax.
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah. Now I have stability. I don't have to deal every second with whether I'm safe or not.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, those things are going to surface. So I have so many people who say, I am in the most stable relationship. I'm finally financially secure. Why the hell am I now feeling anxious? I can't sleep. What's going on in my life? Know that it's not just a choice like, oh, if I don't deal with it, I can repress it. When things are stable, it will surface. And that's what it's meant to do, because finally your body says, okay, we're set. We've got a foundation. Because, oh, I'll say this too. There is this continuous flow of life. It's like an energy force that is happening that moves us toward wholeness and healing. It happens with nature. It happens with the body. And you can't stop it. We are continuously, as a person and a body, as an ecosystem, as a universe, moving toward healing, which means the things that are counter to our healing, the things that are going to get in the way of our healing, when we have safety, they will come up. You're finally in a good place with your partner. Guess what? Your childhood shit's going to come out at that time. And that's not wrong or bad.
There is no rest.
It is literally what is meant to be done, because the second we have safety, then we want healing, because you are always moving as a person toward more wholeness and fullness and health. That's just the way we are operating. That's the life force within us. So when you intentionally say, I'm going to deal with this, you free up resources that are going toward dissociating or repressing it. When you are ready, when you are stable, actually for some people, when you finally take care of yourself, that's when the stuff is going to surface and you've got a choice. And it is going to be really hard work. But then what's on the other side of that is experiencing glimpses of, yeah, you're going to be a person that's working on themselves in one shape or form. And there's going to be things to work on. And it's also going to be acceptance of imperfection. But there are glimpses of the fullness and the richness of humanity. That's not just a, oh, this is so wonderful for me, but it's actually you being able to fulfill the potential that was in your ancestral line. And that, like, it gives me goosebumps. I can't goosebump. That's actually a fun fact. But, like, I feel the sensation of goosebump, but it never happens, you know? It brings up something where I feel that tingling of, I know that I am a part of people finally being able to fulfill their ancestral legacies.
I went from being, you know, feeling a bit disconnected to my therapist being like, how did you feel? Stop telling me what you think. To then feeling like I went to the opposite side, which is I was feeling too much and I was hyper aware and analytical. And now I feel like I'm trying to dial it back to be like, just live in the moment and stop feeling and thinking all of these things. So is there a point where maybe like we're overdoing it and we need to take a break and just kind of like get back to life and learn and have lessons and then go back to therapy?
Yes, you are not a project. You're a person.
Which is hard when you're a perfectionist, because you see yourself as a project. Like, you're like, I can always do better. I can always be better.
Yeah, but the root of perfectionism is actually fear. Fear that if you're not perfect, you won't be loved. Fear that your life can't be full. And you being able to, you know, speak to fear. You've got to turn around and speak to fear. You turn around and say, I'm afraid of this. I'm afraid of being messy. And that's why I think it's important that I create pockets in my life where I am messy, where I take a break.
I posted on my Instagram. I said, I'm doing this interview with Dr. Pauline. Does anyone have any questions? And so I got a couple of questions from friends that wanted to specifically talk about this very thing, where in immigrant families, if you're the one who's going to therapy and you're learning all of these things and you're learning about the codependency of these immigrant families and how everyone needs to be so close. And there's this kind of like fear mindset of like the family has to be close to each other. And you're trying to set boundaries and change the dynamics within your family so that it creates a healthy space for you to continue to grow and be who you are. But you're met with resistance, or you're met with gaslighting as you're trying to have conversations with your parents, which I think anyone who's listening and who has immigrant parents is probably used to them being like, no, that didn't happen. No, what are you talking about? You were fine. You had a great childhood.
Breaks down. I'm the worst parent. I did nothing right.
The guilt trip. Sorry, excuse me for trying to give you a good life. So how do you deal with that? If you are the sole person in your family who's gone through therapy and now you're trying to have these conversations and no one's listening to you and you're feeling gaslit.
Okay. So hard little nugget, do just your part and expect this. This is what cycle breaking is going to bring. Just like I said, when there's stability, you can expect your shit to come out. When you're the cycle breaker in a family that is not doing the cycle breaking work, accept that you will get and expect that you will get shame, guilt, confusion, misunderstanding, punishment, gaslight. You'll get all of it in different forms, depending on your family and their personality and the tools in their toolkit, right? So this is the expected work. Don't see it as I'm doing something wrong. See it as I'm doing something right. Going back to dismantling those systems, you go to your boss and say, hey, I think that our department is really operating with some anti-Black policies. You think you're going to get like a, wow, thank you so much. You might get defensiveness. You might get put on leave. You might have all sorts of things happen because when you speak to power, you're going to get resistance. And recognize that in order to move through, you do need to create a bubble of you. You can't change your whole family dynamic. You can change your part in the family dynamic. They still want to dance the way they want to dance. You can change the steps that you are operating in. You can't go in trying to change the whole family. That is too overwhelming. And then you learn about intergenerational trauma and you're like, oh my God, I've got 3 to 7 generations living in me. And now I've got to do it for all of them. It's like, yeah, you're the chosen one, but for your life, focus on your jurisdiction. Expect that this is going to happen when you go against the status quo.
How can we reframe and change our relationship with even something as simple as money, which is so important and such a critical part of living a good life, is having money and having power? How can we change our mindset about money? Knowing that if you came from an immigrant family that's like, save everything, security is everything, and that's what was basically taught to you, how can we get over this? How can we have an abundance mentality and just free ourselves?
Yeah, well, I mean, first and foremost, you always have compassion for where it came from. Being frugal saved somebody. Being frugal was a way. Wondering where that next paycheck was going to come from was an anxiety mindset that led to making certain choices that potentially increased the probability of survival. Long story, but it's, you recognize what the function of the original behavior was, and you say thank you to it. You say thank you. Somewhere down the line, having that mentality and reusing a Tupperware 6,000 times may have helped to create the kind of life that I have now. It's so easy when you're not in that mindset anymore, or you've been educated, to look down on that and say, that's a really gross coping mechanism, or look at all the difficult mindset that I got, rather than also having compassion for the function that it served. Yeah. When you have that compassion,
I like that approach.
You say, okay, what's my story? What were the messages? I literally have people write down messages, things they've been told about money. Same thing happens with marriage or relationships. What have you been told about it? Whatever the concept is, but we're staying with money. What are the messages that I've gotten explicitly? What are the messages I saw modeled? What are the frameworks that happen? Like really making it concrete and saying, do these things fit with the values that I have? What do I want? Maybe I want to be an artist. Maybe I want a very different life for myself. Maybe I have a very different value. I don't want things and stability in that way. I'm okay with that. I want experiences. So if that's the case, you look at the messaging and then you look at the values and say, are these things congruent? If they're not, the middle kind of column, skill set. Actually being able to make changes, behavioral changes that are going to come with a lot of discomfort, buying yourself something that is an experience that feels really uncomfortable to spend money on.
Oh, I've done that.
And living in the discomfort, breathing through the discomfort and saying, I'm feeling the messages alive in my body, and I'm also continuing to act in the ways that move me toward the things I value. I am in process. And then you create encouragement. You bring that friend who can say, I'm so glad you did it. Why this friend is so, this is the photo. I'm turning 40 this year. You can tell. Yeah. You bring people into your life that can say, I saw how difficult that was, because you know you need that support, because you're not from one column to the next yet. So people want the quick, easy fix to get over that mindset. There's no quick, easy fix. Life is hard. Hello, that's Western therapy. What's the most effective way in 6 sessions? Now it's one session. You get this one session model of da 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 da. It's like, we're not projects. We are people. And so if you have compassion, where did this come from, right? And you know something about your family. I don't know all the particulars of my family, but I'm Armenian. I know my parents and grandparents and ancestors survived through a genocide. They had to in order for me to be alive here. Knowing that is like, okay, how does that influence our interaction with money? How does that influence how we either saw the world available to us, open for us, or for us at all? Look at where you come from and have compassion for some of that. So then you can give actual credit to the small but really profound changes you are making. And again, listening to your body is going to give it to you. When you order that thing and they say, you want avocado, and you say yes, and then all of a sudden you're sitting there like, oh my God, it's already a $15 toast. Why did it get the $5 avocado? These are the things that make it so that I'm not going to have a house. And you're sitting there, you breathe in to say, I am so glad that I am going with what I know is important in this moment to me. And I'd also like to really enjoy the company of the people that I came with. I don't eat like this every day. And you breathe into your body and you refocus on being present with them. And when it comes, you eat every last damn bite. That's how you slowly move toward it. If you think mindset should be like this and, oh, this is an easy thing to fix, you're actually from that place of self-judgment going to lose out on the hard work and giving yourself credit along the journey as you're moving toward the things that you want. So often I have children of immigrants that are feeling guilty about the things now they can have that maybe their families didn't. And I say, look, you're only looking at it from one angle. There's another angle. If you've ever gone to like, it's basically a family party. In Farsi, it's called mehmunis. Yeah, if you've gone to a mehmuni, where do they put the grannies and the grandpas in the wheelchairs? They take them right up to the dance floor. And what do? They sit there and they watch the younger generation dance, because seeing them dance brings them enjoyment. The thing about families that are collective in nature is sometimes they're with you in the really difficult periods and you can feel like, oh my gosh, your stuff is leaking out all over me. The plus side of a collectivistic family, and of course, boundary setting and all that stuff is important. The plus side is they also share in your joys. And rather than just guilt, maybe you do feel guilty. That's self-awareness. You have things your parents didn't, your grandparents didn't.
Yeah.
But there can also be alongside that the joy that they're getting to see you thrive, and it is fulfilling something within them as well, because we move collectively through these things.
It's such a positive way to end this podcast interview and this specific session, this therapy session we've all collectively had together with Dr. Pauline.
Therapeutic for me too.
But for anybody who's listening to this, you know, use this as your opportunity to reflect and to change your life for the better. And also check out Pauline's website. You have resources, you have blogs. Her Instagram is amazing. That's how I found Pauline, was her Instagram. And I was like, who is this woman who's telling me about my life on Instagram? She knows me. So thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your insights. You're brilliant. And this was a really great conversation.
I appreciate it. That feels really wonderful to hear. This is me putting together the work of so many different people that have influenced me. And so I feel really excited to be in this space and honored to be in it. And it's like, this is our time right now. So I hope that I am speaking to all the other change makers across a variety of fields, including you. I mean, the fact that we're sitting here talking about this and that somebody can hear it and feel their life experience resonate in that is like the biggest gift, not just to my ancestors, to my inner child as well. So thank you.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. As always, make sure to subscribe to She's Interesting, rate the podcast, leave a review for us, and follow us on Instagram and TikTok. Thank you.